Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today, our special guest is Mike Cantu. Mike's an entrepreneur who has made his fortune buying homes below market value and either holding them as rentals or flipping them for a profit. He works out of his home, keeps everything simple, and drives a truck with about 500,000 miles, 511,000 miles, I believe, to be accurate. You know, we've talked kind of in the first segment about lots of accomplishments, kind of. There was an era where you were building and creating building lots, and then everything, the music stopped, and you didn't have the right inventory, and so you had some challenges for a while. So let's talk about facing up to something that seemed overwhelming, really.
Another one of those lessons in life, Bruce, the best laid plans. I got introduced to this thing in the market called timing. And up to that point, it didn't really hit home. And then when I realized the economy dropped off a cliff, the music had stopped, and I had more projects in place, three large development projects. It's a big subdivision, two condo projects. I had a dozen lot splits going and probably half a dozen spec homes. I was spread out, more going than I'd ever had in my life. The music stopped, and there I was.
What year was this?
That was 1989.
89, okay. Somewhere very close to you, I was doing something. Thank God it was only seven custom homes. But you managed your way through that. How long did it take?
Bruce, from the beginning of the downfall to the time where I had it officially cleaned up was almost 18 months.
Okay.
Every day I got up and was in mess cleaning up mode.
Now, you worked kind of at a real estate office, as I recall.
9 months of that 18 months, I did work at a real estate office. It was where I had one of my large projects, and I had to sell the stuff, and I couldn't count on anybody else, so I figured any human that walked in there, we're going to go look at something I owned.
Okay. There was a guy that had money, I remember you quoting something, and he made an interesting comment about his unavailability of those funds. What was that quote?
As an agent, we were all assigned a farm area, and I had a very large farm area, and this guy owned about 80% of the farm. And I thought, how on earth did somebody amass this much land? And he used to stop in the office all the time to mooch free coffee. And every time he came in, I would try and get him to list one of his parcels with me. And he'd say, nope, I can't do that, Mike. All my money's tied up in cash. The last thing he needed was more.
He didn't need more cash. Okay. Well, there's times in the market where that's not a bad idea, is not to participate. And that was 1 year, or land certainly was not, mm-hmm. not so hot. What did you learn about yourself during those 18 months that has held you in good stead?
I learned what I was capable of, that it was overwhelming at the beginning, and the person that finished that was not the same person that started it. That's for darn sure. But I found out a lot of what I was capable of. Conscience came into play there, too, that I realized that a lot of people had entrusted me with their hard-earned money in hopes of return of and on their principal in hopes of a better tomorrow. And that was a big burden on me, making those people whole. That was the biggest concern.
It's very heavy having other people's money.
Mm-hmm. And I have a huge risk aversion to it to this day.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens when you survive one of those downturns, whatever the outcome, is you have a good memory for the next one.
A whole new appreciation for other people's money.
When this one hit, lots of people had the opportunity to stick it out and make it through, or, you know, just bail and rent out properties and, you know, and not worry about the debt. Did you see some of each of those sides play out where people did amazing things and stuck with it?
No, I wondered if I was the Lone Ranger.
Okay.
And why on earth was I doing this?
Well, I'm talking about in the recent one, like 06, 07, you know.
I saw lots of people walk away very early, and it was surprising.
Yeah, kind of.
Mm-hmm. This didn't work out. Next.
Well, Mick Blackwell had an interesting statement. Remember, you told me he pulled out a deed of trust, and on it was something about a promise to pay.
Uh-huh. And I, back in our development, when things went downhill, and I had asked Mick, I said, what do we do now? Do we file bankruptcy? And that's when his face slowly wadded up like a piece of tinfoil, and I got the lecture, and that's when he read the verbiage on the promissory note about, we signed here where it says, I promise to pay, and I got the lecture about people's hard-earned money entrusting it to us in hopes of a better tomorrow for them. And that was the end of that discussion, and we cleaned up the mess.
So how important has Mick Blackwell been to, you know, your life, basically?
Unbelievably important from many, many aspects. I was blessed to cross paths with him. It was not on good terms when we first met. But you can read about a lot of things, and you can hear about a lot of things. But seeing and witnessing is an entirely different story. And I witnessed firsthand, sitting in the passenger seat of his old gray pickup truck. I witnessed his life. I saw what he had accomplished. So the seeing part of it and getting him to explain how he did it. So I had a role model walking in front of me, and I just kept thinking. When early on, I found out he made $1,000 a day from his apartments. And when I heard that, I was shocked that he still worked. I didn't understand. And then I thought, I've got to get to know this guy better, and I want to duplicate what he did.
Those are those fourplexes in Pomona?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That was not an easy $1,000 a day.
No, it was not. But at the same time, $1,000 a day, when I was working for him at $5 an hour, I was making 40, and he was making $1,000 before he started working.
You were just working half days, though?
Yeah, half days, and like Mick said, it didn't matter whether it was the first half or the second half, 12-hour days. And
now, you said you start off on bad terms. I have to ask.
Oh, there was an incident, Bruce. I can't elaborate all of it.
Did you peeling away, spraying rocks on him have something to do with the end?
Absolutely. I dropped him. Then I ran into him at Connolly's Hardware Store about a year later, and he asked me what I was up to, and I told him I was in real estate. And he said, well, let me come around the corner and talk about it. He came around my aisle, and I went around the corner to his aisle, and we talked through the stuff. I said, I'm no dummy, Blackwell. I know you want a piece of me.
That's funny.
Okay. So he tried to set me up in the hardware store.
You had a goal of free and clear, and he had a different opinion of that at the time.
Oh, yes. And see, I love the great umbrella of real estate because there's so many benefits under that umbrella and so many different game plans and niches that you can do. And Mick's philosophy had always been that you get long-term fixed rate amortizing financing and you let complete strangers known as tenants pay these things off for you. Well, there's nothing wrong with that program. However, I wanted to expedite my program, that not only did I want the amortization, but I wanted everything, every extra dollar that came into my life to be applied to my debt, because I wanted the debt gone, because I wanted the benefit of the free and clear houses. That's part of the reason I still drive the truck I drive, Bruce. I still have a hard time taking house money and applying it to an automobile.
You can take vacations, though, right?
Oh, they're mandatory.
Okay. Some house has got an assignment for that.
Absolutely.
Okay. How many people do you flip to in a year? Different people.
I'm going to look back at this year. I don't think I've hit the 5 mark. It's three or four people, the usual people, and it's not always the same people every year. If I look back at 2005, the guy that bought most of the wholesale deals that had both hands raised and took most of the stuff, he's been out of business since 2008.
Okay. How does somebody make the cut?
There's a lot of criteria, but first and foremost is performance in your word. We don't need a bunch of paperwork. You give your all, take it, and from there it's performance. That you've got to perform.
So,
and make it easy and convenient to do business with.
Okay. So how do they get off the list?
Not performing, saying they'll take it and then at the last minute changing their mind, or saying they'll take it and then coming back for a different price, trying to better the price, or saying they will take it and attempting it to sell it to somebody after that, substitute another buyer in for themselves. There's quite a few things that can go wrong there.
Okay. Once they're off the list, can they get back on?
There's only been one person that got put in the ice box and managed to thaw out and get back on the list.
Okay. That's funny. Okay. How you find properties in 2014? Is that going to be different than 2013?
Not for me, Bruce. I don't think I did a single deal in 2013. In fact, I know I didn't do a single deal out of the multiple listing. I did one deal last year out of the multiple listing, so that's certainly not where my deal source is.
Okay, so...
And it's back to the private party arena.
So you're direct mailing to...
A lot of direct mail.
Okay. It's absentee owners, typically?
Typically, we start with absentee owners, and from niche markets, I love a good niche list, but as I explained to my daughter, we can categorize everybody who owns a house into one of two categories, and that's either owner-occupied or non-owner-occupied. From there, you go down into the niche list, and same thing. Each niche list, they're either owner-occupied or non-owner-occupied.
Explain a niche list, I'm sorry.
A code enforcement list.
Okay.
That, once again, you go down that list, and if they're non-owner-occupied and they're on that code enforcement list, they've already got my letter. But now it may be a more timely letter with a different message on it.
Okay. How many renditions of the letter right now do you have?
I'm just mailing one letter for, well, let's see, using three different letters, but they're for different arenas.
Okay. How different is that letter from 5 years ago?
I've actually shortened it down, and a good friend of mine, I helped him get in the direct mail business, and in his previous life, he was a journalist, and I got copies of Richard's letters. He's up in the Bay Area, and he actually had some very good stuff in his to where I hijacked a few sentences and paragraphs and integrated those in, but right now I just one basic letter for absentee market.
One page?
It's a one page.
Do you have it on colored paper, white paper?
White paper, black print. The latest change to it was my email address. I've dropped my email address off of it. I put it on there for about 4 years. I never bought a house by way of email, probably because I don't do email.
Yeah.
But what I noticed more about the email responses, they were either rude or take me off the list, but... More of them were rude, and I thought, okay, I see. They can hide behind a rude email rather than pick up the phone and tell me what's on their mind. I didn't buy a house using my email, so that's the latest thing I've removed.
Okay. So it's still live. Now, not all the time is your phone answered live, is it?
No.
Okay.
Only when someone's there.
Okay. So you'll have calls go to the recorder?
Yes, my professional sounding recorder, Bruce. You know what it used to say? Leave a message at the beep. And about 10 years ago, I really cleaned it up. Now it says, hi, this is Mike. Please leave a message at the beep.
Okay. So, partly is that at this stage, you don't have to capture every deal. You're not concerned about it to that extent.
No.
Okay.
No, as long as my attitude has always been, as long as I've got projects going and stuff lined up after that, I'm perfectly content. I really don't care what the rest of the world is doing. I'm more concerned about my day-to-day pipeline of deals and keeping some contractors going.
As the seller that's responding, have they changed? Are they have access to information more easily?
Oh, yes. This game has changed tremendously over the years, and the internet changed everything. I had a conversation yesterday with a man, and we were talking about values and kind of vague, and then we got a little bit more specific and a little bit more specific, and then we talked about the high and the low sale, and I mentioned a street name, and he threw out the addresses. So he had done his homework, and there's a lot more information out there.
So they can look at a Zillow or whatever and figure a value, and how hard is it to negotiate with somebody that's looking at a number saying, well, that's like an appraisal?
Well, in this guy's case, he grabbed onto the Zillow that was a 183, and I was on multiple listing, and Value Map said 113. And I said, I got to shoot you over something and compare some notes here. I have $70,000 spread in there. So I suggested a couple other sites, and actually Zillow wasn't too far off. The Value Map was way off.
Okay.
So as I explain, Zillow can be your friend or it can be your enemy. And when it's my enemy, I refer to it as guesso. It's they're guessing. They're going on square footage and not taking lot size into consideration, any historical value, any construction quality, different styles of construction. It's basically a square footage valuation, which works great for tract homes, but not in a custom home neighborhood.
When you get a phone call, how often, when you answer it live, how often of a percentage do you make an offer to that person?
It depends. I'd say this year, Bruce, I'm going to say probably 1 out of 10 calls.
Okay. The other 9, they're just no indication of any flexibility?
Or? Either they owe more than I'm interested in, their opinion of value is out in right field, they think it's worth a lot more than it is. My whole game has always been, let me take you to the same place a realtor would in a lot less time, minus a small margin for surprises. So when I get the call from the person that's trying to save the commission that's picked out the top dollar, that's not going to work.
Right.
And I do get those calls, and I had one of them yesterday. And then the other call, well, I had several calls yesterday. Another one, it was a good house, good neighborhood, but they had a first and a second. I thought it was a 250 house. They had a 270 first and a 30 second.
Okay.
That's a referral to a short sale broker friend of mine.
And how often do you get calls from other investors with, you're sort of like a clearinghouse at this point, I think.
Yeah. A couple times a month I usually get a call. This is what I got. Do you have a buyer for it? In fact, I think I called you or mentioned one of those to you yesterday, a middleman deal.
I don't know if you checked your messages. I said I'd take it.
I didn't check my messages, Bruce. Okay.
I just would like to see the inside of it.
Okay.
That's funny.
No, I enjoy playing middleman, and depending, I really get a kick out of putting two good people together. I had a deal earlier this year. It was a student, a good friend, I was actually 10, and another friend, Jeff. Two of my favorite people. The deal started getting skinny, and I just stepped out of it. Made sure that the two of them did business, and when all the dust settled, I told them they each owed me lunch.
Okay.
But I was thrilled to see, because Tim wanted to keep the house, and Jeff wanted the wholesale fee, and it started shrinking, and I ran into title challenges and a few other things, but when the dust settled, I was happy to see two good people do business.
And you've earned the right for that to be pretty repetitive in nature over the years, so.
Yeah, and occasionally, Bruce, somebody brings me something that either the numbers aren't right or it's such a strange property to where I've got to be honest and say that I don't know that I can do anything with that.
Right. Going back a few years, I remember getting a phone call from you saying, I've been asked to speak at the Jack Miller seminar, and I'm really not very happy about it. I remember you saying, if I could pay you $5,000 to take my place, I would. And then you had a pretty cool response from the audience after the talk. What did they do?
I got a standing ovation.
Standing ovation. You called me up and you went, okay, I can see why you do this now.
That was a major, major for me, getting up in front of a couple of hundred people for a few hours. That I've heard that is the number one fear of the American public.
Either burning to death or speaking in public.
I've heard that more people rather burn to death than than to speak. And I heard somewhere that I can't imagine that one. I would much rather do the eulogy at the funeral than be the one in the coffin at the funeral.
Yeah.
So I would not want to burn to death. And the public speaking, once I got through that, I realized, okay, from a confidence level, that was a huge one.
Okay.
And to this day, I still get nervous.
You know, what's funny about that is when you speak, heard a lot of speakers, probably more information happens per minute with your stuff than any other speaker. And I think it's still because you're uncomfortable in a sense, because you're funny and you have lots of stories, but I don't know if you've loosened up and said a lot of those. Mostly it's just content.
Well, I am an education fanatic, Bruce, and when I'm sitting in the audience, the last thing I want to hear is somebody winging it and making stuff up and filling in the gaps with and. I realize it's just not an hour that I'm taking up. It's a cumulative hour of a whole bunch of people. And when you add all those hours up, and it could be 400 hours if there's 200 people there and you're there for 2 hours, and to think for 400 hours of the human race being used up, I want to deliver something good. So I'm very conscientious about what I do say in public.
How many times did you speak this last year?
Zero.
That's what I thought. I
did not speak one time this year. I made a conscious effort to take the year off from any public speaking only because we are in my favorite market, a recovering market that's on the rise. And I thought, I've got deals to do. And I also made the commitment that I was only going to work part-time this year.
We're going to have a Millionaire Maker this year, so hopefully you can be one of the speakers here. I would enjoy that a lot.
Okay.
You still attend seminars?
Yes, absolutely, Bruce. I went to two of yours this year. I've been to a couple of John Schaub seminars. I am very, very picky on the education, though, because there's a lot of new people out there teaching, and I really, really like to learn from the real deal, somebody that teaches what they do, that's still out there in the trenches, or they did it their entire life and have retired and teaching the principles of it. So I am very picky, but no, that's always a goal, is my education.
Favorite all-time trainer?
Jack Miller.
Jack Miller.
Hands down. I learned more from Jack. He passed away, I think it was about 4 years ago now. I went home down the street from my office and sat in my home office chair, and I looked at my Jack Miller library, and I felt very fortunate that I have 51 Jack Miller notebooks, that I was able to go to 51 seminars, plus heard him speak many more times. And that was just such a huge influence, life-changing information.
Yeah, that's, and from what you said, you feel the same responsibility when you speak, and obviously he gave our industry the best shot anybody could.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember one time you told me an example where he was looking at tax law at midnight or something, and his wife was shaking his head because he was underneath a...
He was actually at his son's house in San Diego, at Chris's house, and Chris thought there was a burglar in the house, and he went downstairs, and at 3 a.m, Jack was sitting in a recliner chair with a sheet over him and a flashlight reading the tax code, giggling to himself.
I guess that's the guy you want to get taught by. Favorite books. We touched on it. If you don't have three.
Now, Bruce, I have hundreds and hundreds of books. Now, I have in my home office, I have what I call the A library.
Okay.
And there's somewhere between at least 500 books in there. You've been in there.
Yeah.
And then in the garage is the B library. And then at my office house in the basement is the C library. I know there's thousands of pounds of books. And just off the top of my head, the ones that really, really influence me, I have an annual read. The first one is Richest Man in Babylon by George Clausen. That is the rules of gold and the laws of money. It's an annual read, takes about an hour.
Okay.
One of the first books that I read that I got at a thrift store and paid 50 cents for it was Think and Grow Rich. I have been given several very nice copies of it since then, and that book I've read at least a dozen times, and every time I read it, new stuff comes out every single time. And then from the real estate arena, there's two books I'm going to recommend. The first one is one that really, really influenced me and motivated me because I could relate to the man's lifestyle and as a human being. That was Bill Green with an E at the end, and the book was Think Like a Tycoon. That was put out, I'm going to say, in the late 70s. Should be able to track a copy of that down. And in the modern-day world, one of my favorite real estate books is The Millionaire Real Estate Investor by Gary Keller of Keller Williams. That is a great book. It covers retailing, wholesaling, keeping, everything that I do.
Okay.
Big influence in that book, too. And I wanted to put a little emphasis on the one chapter. It says Harvest a Million, and I knew that's where, looking at the table of contents, that must be the chapter where you sell everything and head off into the sunset. And when I got to that chapter, that really floored me. That was about all the people that harvest $1 million in net rents every year.
Oh. Okay. So you said, okay, I won't discard that chapter.
That was a game changer.
Okay. I think that's part, you know, what we want to maybe pass on is there's only a few people that you really want to hang around with in the sense of having influence of you on your career. And we've got to run out of time, but, you know, you've been one of those people for me, and I've been honored to be one of those for you. So,
absolutely. And, Bruce, one of the things that's – we're all looking for the knowledge, but what I'm really looking for at this point in the game is the wisdom.
Mike, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Likewise, Bruce. My pleasure.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.